the woman's hand or whisper into her ear. All this would have an intoxicating effect. Women would find themselves dragged into a kind of maelstrom, both spiritually uplifted and sexually excited. Hundreds of women succumbed during these spiritual visits, for he would also tell them that they could not repent until they had sinned. And who better to sin with than Rasputin? Rasputin understood the intimate connection between the sexual and the spiritual. Spirituality, the love of God, is a sublimated version of sexual love. The language of the religious mystics of the Middle Ages is full of erotic images. The contemplation of God and of the sublime can offer a kind of mental orgasm. There is no more seductive brew than the combination of the spiritual and the sexual, the high and the low. When you talk of spiritual matters, then let your looks and physical presence hint of sexuality at the same time. Make the harmony of the universe and union with God seem to confuse with physical harmony and the union between two people. If you can make the endgame of your seduction appear as a spiritual experience, you will heighten the physical pleasure and create a seduction with a deep and lasting effect. Reversal. Letting your targets feel that your affection is neither temporary nor superficial will often make them fall deeper under your spell. In some, though, it can arouse an anxiety, the fear of commitment, of a claustrophobic relationship with no exits. Never let your spiritual lures seem to be leading in that direction, then. To focus attention on the distant future may implicitly constrict their freedom. You should be seducing them, not offering to marry them. What you want is to make them lose themselves in the moment, experiencing the timeless depth of your feelings in the present tense. Religious ecstasy is about intensity, not temporal extensity. Giovanni Casanova used many spiritual lures in his seductions, the occult, anything that would inspire lofty sentiments. For the time that he was involved with a woman, she would feel that he would do anything for her, that he was not just using her only to abandon her. But she also knew that when it became convenient to end the affair, he would cry, give her a magnificent gift, then quietly leave. This was just what many young women wanted, a temporary diversion from marriage or an oppressive family. Sometimes pleasure is best when we know it's fleeting. Chapter 20. Mix Pleasure with Pain. The greatest mistake in seduction is being too nice. At first, perhaps your kindness is charming, but it soon grows monotonous. You're trying too hard to please and seem insecure. Instead of overwhelming your targets with niceness, try inflicting some pain. Lure them in with focused attention, then change direction, appearing suddenly uninterested. Make them feel guilty and insecure. Even instigate a breakup, subjecting them to an emptiness and pain that will give you room to maneuver. Now a rapprochement, an apology, a return to your earlier kindness will turn them weak at the knees. The lower the lows you create, the greater the highs. To heighten the erotic charge, create the excitement of fear. The emotional roller coaster. One hot summer afternoon in 1894, Don Mateo Diaz, a 38-year-old resident of Seville, decided to visit a local tobacco factory. Because of his connections, Don Mateo was allowed to tour the place, but his interest was not in the business side. Don Mateo liked young girls, and hundreds of them worked in the factory. Just as he had expected that day, many of them were in a state of near undress because of the heat. It was quite a spectacle. He enjoyed the sights for a while, but the noise and the temperature soon got to him. As he was heading for the door, though, a worker of no more than 16 called out to him, "Caballero, If you will give me a penny, I will sing you a little song. The girl's name was Conchita Perez, and she looked young and innocent, in fact, beautiful, with a sparkle in her eye that suggested a taste for adventure, the perfect prey. He listened to her song, which seemed vaguely suggestive, tossed her a coin that was equal to a month's salary, tipped his hat, then left. It was never good to come on too strong, too early. As he walked along the street, he plotted how he would lure her into an affair. Suddenly, he felt a hand on his arm, and he turned to see her walking alongside him. It was too hot to work. Would he be a gentleman and escort her home? Of course. Do you have a lover? He asked her. No, she said. I am Mosita, which means pure, a virgin. Conchita lived with her mother in a run-down part of town. Don Mateo exchanged pleasantries, slipped the mother some money, he knew from experience how important it was to keep the mother happy, then left. He considered waiting a few days, but he was impatient and returned the following morning. The mother was out. He and Conchita resumed their playful banter from the day before, and to his surprise, she suddenly sat in his lap, put her arms around him, and kissed him. His strategy flying out the window, he took hold of her and returned the kiss. She immediately jumped up, her eyes flashing with anger. "You are trifling with me," she said, "using me for a quick thrill." Don Mateo denied having any such intentions and apologized for going too far. When he left, he felt confused. She had started it all. Why should he feel guilty? And yet, he did. Young girls can be so unpredictable. It's best to break them in slowly. Over the next few days, Don Mateo was the perfect gentleman. He visited every day, showered mother and daughter with gifts, made no advances, at least not at first. The damned girl had become so familiar with him that she would dress in front of him or greet him in her nightgown. These glimpses of her body drove him crazy, and he would sometimes try to steal a kiss or a caress, only to have her push him away and scold him. Weeks went by. Clearly he had shown that his was not a passing fancy. Tired of the endless courtship, he took Conchita's mother aside one day and proposed that he set the girl up in a house of her own. He would treat her like a queen. She would have everything she wanted. So, of course, would her mother. Surely his proposal would satisfy the two women. But the next day, a note came from Conchita, expressing not gratitude, but recrimination. He was trying to buy her love. "You shall never see me again," she concluded. He hurried to the house, only to discover that the women had moved out that very morning without leaving word where they were going. Don Mateo felt terrible. Yes, he had acted like a boor. Next time he would wait months or years, if need be, before being so bold. Soon, however, another thought assailed him. He would never see Conchita again. Only then did he realize how much he loved her. The winter passed, the worst of Mateo's life. One spring day he was walking down the street when he heard someone calling his name. He looked up. Conchita was standing in an open window, beaming with excitement. She bent down toward him and he kissed her hand, beside himself with joy. "Why had she disappeared so suddenly? It was all going too quickly," she said. She had been afraid of his intentions and of her own feelings, but seeing him again, she was certain that she loved him. Yes, she was ready to be his mistress. She would prove it. She would come to him. Being apart had changed them both, he thought. A few nights later, as promised, she appeared at his house. They kissed and began to undress. He wanted to savor every minute, to take it slowly, but he felt like a caged bull finally set free. He followed her into bed, his hands all over her. He started to take off her underwear, but it was laced up in some complicated way. Eventually, he had to sit up and take a look. She was wearing some elaborate canvas contraption of a kind he had never seen. No matter how hard he tugged and pulled, it would not come off. He felt like hitting Conchita. He was so distraught, but instead, he started to cry. She explained she wanted to do everything with him, yet to remain a mocita. This was her protection. Exasperated, he sent her home. Over the next few weeks, Don Mateo began to reassess his opinion of Conchita. He saw her flirting with other men and dancing a suggestive flamenco in a bar. She wasn't a mocita, he decided. She was playing him for money. And yet, he could not leave her. Another man would take his place, an unbearable thought. She would invite him to spend the night in her bed as long as he promised not to force himself on her, and then, as if to torture him beyond reason, she would get into bed naked, supposedly because of the heat. All this he put up with on the grounds that no other man had such privileges. But one night, pushed to the limits of frustration, he exploded with anger and issued an ultimatum: either give me what I want or you will never see me again. Suddenly, Conchita started to cry. He had never seen her cry, and it moved him. She, too, was tired of all this, she said, her voice trembling. If it wasn't too late, she was ready to accept the proposal she had once turned down. Set her up in a house, and he would see what a devoted mistress she would be. Don Mateo wasted no time. He bought her a villa, gave her plenty of money to decorate it. After 8 days, the house was ready. She would receive him there at midnight. What joys awaited him! Don Mateo showed up at the appointed hour. The barred door to the courtyard was closed. He rang the bell. She came to the other side of the door. "Kiss my hands," she said through the bars. "Now, kiss the hem of my skirt and the tip of my foot in its slipper." He did as she requested. "That is good," she said. "Now you may go." His shocked expression just made her laugh. She ridiculed him, then made a confession. She was repulsed by him. Now that she had a villa in her name, she was free of him at last. She called out, and a young man appeared from the shadows of the courtyard. As Don Mateo watched, too stunned to move, they began to make love on the floor right before his eyes. The next morning, Conchita appeared at Don Mateo's house, supposedly to see if he had committed suicide. To her surprise, he hadn't. In fact, he slapped her so hard she fell to the ground. "Conchita," he said, "you have made me suffer beyond all human strength. You have invented moral tortures to try them on the only man who loved you passionately. I now declare that I am going to possess you by force." Conchita screamed that she would never be his, but he hit her again and again. Finally, moved by her tears, he stopped. Now she looked up at him lovingly. "Forget the past," she said. "Forget all that I have done." Now that he hit her, now that she could see his pain, she felt certain he truly loved her. She was still a mocita. The affair with the young man the night before had been only for show, ending as soon as he had left, and she still belonged to him. "You're not going to take me by force. I await you in my arms." Finally, she was sincere. To his supreme delight, he discovered that she was, indeed, still a virgin. Interpretation. Don Mateo and Conchita Perez are characters in the 1896 novella Woman and Puppet by Pierre Louis. Based on a true story, the Miss Charpillon episode in Casanova's memoirs, the novella has served as the basis for two films, Joseph von Sternberg's Devil is a Woman with Marlene Dietrich and Luis Buñuel's That Obscure Object of Desire. In Luis's story, Conchita takes a proud and aggressive older man and in the space of a few months turns him into an abject slave. Her method is simple. She stimulates as many emotions as possible, including heavy doses of pain. She excites his lust, then makes him feel base for taking advantage of her. She gets him to play the protector, then makes him feel guilty for trying to buy her. Her sudden disappearance anguishes him. He has lost her, so that when she reappears, never by accident, he feels intense joy, which, however, she quickly turns back into tears. Jealousy and humiliation then precede the final moment when she gives him her virginity. Even after this, according to the story, she finds ways to continue to torment him. Each low she inspires, guilt, despair, jealousy, emptiness, creates the space for a more intense high. He becomes an addict, hooked on the alternation of charge and withdrawal. Your seduction should never follow a simple course upward toward pleasure and harmony. The climax will come too soon and the pleasure will be weak. What makes us intensely appreciate something is previous suffering. A brush with death makes us fall in love with life. A long journey makes a return home that much more pleasurable. Your task is to create moments of sadness, despair, and anguish, to create the tension that allows for a great release. Don't worry about making people angry. Anger is a sure sign that you have your hooks in them. Nor should you be afraid that if you make yourself difficult, people will flee. We only abandon those who bore us. The ride on which you take your victims can be torturous, but never dull. At all costs, keep your targets emotional and on edge. Create enough highs and lows, and you will wear away the last vestiges of their willpower. Harshness and kindness. In 1972, Henry Kissinger, then President Richard Nixon's assistant for national security affairs, received a request for an interview from the famous Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci. Kissinger rarely gave interviews. He had no control over the final product, and he was a man who needed to be in control. But he had read Fallaci's interview with a North Vietnamese general, and it had been instructive. She was extremely well informed on the Vietnam War. Perhaps he could gather some information of his own, pick her brain. He decided to ask for a pre-interview, a preliminary meeting. He would grill her on different subjects. If she passed the test, he would grant her an interview proper. They met, and he was impressed. She was extremely intelligent and tough. It would be an enjoyable challenge to outwit her and prove that he was tougher. He agreed to a short interview a few days later. To Kissinger's annoyance, Fallaci began the interview by asking him whether he was disappointed by the slow pace of the peace negotiations with North Vietnam. He would not discuss the negotiations. He had made that clear in the pre-interview, yet she continued the same line of questioning. He grew a little angry. "That's enough," he said. "I don't want to talk any more about Vietnam." Although she didn't immediately abandon the subject, her questions became gentler. What were his personal feelings toward the leaders of South and North Vietnam? Still, he ducked. "I'm not the kind of person to be swayed by emotion. Emotions serve no purpose," he said. She moved to grander philosophical issues, war, peace. She praised him for his role in the rapprochement with China. Without realizing it, Kissinger began to open up. He talked of the pain he felt in dealing with Vietnam, the pleasures of wielding power. Then suddenly, the harsher questions returned. Was he simply Nixon's lackey, as many suspected? Up and down she went, alternately baiting and flattering him. His goal had been to pump her for information while revealing nothing about himself. By the end, though, she had given him nothing, while he had revealed a range of embarrassing opinions, his view of women as playthings, for instance, and his belief that he was popular with the public because people saw him as a kind of lonesome cowboy, the hero who cleans things up by himself. When the interview was published, Nixon, Kissinger's boss, was livid about it. In 1973, the Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, granted Falachi an interview. He knew how to handle the press, be noncommittal, speak in generalities, seem firm yet polite. This approach had worked 1,000 times before. Falachi began the interview on a personal level, asking how it felt to be a king, to be the target of assassination attempts, and why the Shah always seemed so sad. He talked of the burdens of his position, the pain and loneliness he felt. It seemed a release of sorts to talk about his professional problems. As he talked, Falachi said little, her silence goading him on. Then suddenly she changed the subject. He was having difficulties with his second wife. Surely that must hurt him. This was a sore spot, and Pahlavi got angry. He tried to change the subject, but she kept returning to it. "Why waste time talking about wives and women?" he said. He then went so far as to criticize women in general, their lack of creativity, their cruelty. Falachi kept at him. He had dictatorial tendencies, and his country lacked basic freedoms. Falachi's own books were on his government's blacklist. Hearing this, the Shah seemed somewhat taken aback. Perhaps he was dealing with a subversive writer. But then she softened her tone again, asked him about his many achievements. The pattern repeated. The moment he relaxed, she blindsided him with a sharp question. When he grew bitter, she lightened the mood. Like Kissinger, he found himself opening up despite himself and mentioning things he would later regret, such as his intention to raise the price of oil. Slowly, he fell under her spell, even began to flirt with her. "Even if you're on the blacklist of my authorities," he said at the end of the interview, "I'll put you on the white list of my heart." Interpretation. Most of Falachi's interviews were with powerful leaders, men and women with an overwhelming need to control the situation, to avoid revealing anything embarrassing. This put her and her subjects in conflict, since getting them to open up, grow emotional, give up control, was exactly what she wanted. The classic seductive approach of charm and flattery would get her nowhere with these people. They would see right through it. Instead, Falachi preyed on their emotions, alternating harshness and kindness. She would ask a cruel question that touched on the deepest insecurities of the subject, who would get emotional and defensive. Deep down, though, something else would stir inside them, the desire to prove to Falachi that they did not deserve her implicit criticisms. Unconsciously, they wanted to please her, to make her like them. When she then shifted tone, indirectly praising them, they felt they were winning her over and were encouraged to open up. Without realizing it, they would give freer rein to their emotions. In social situations, we all wear masks and keep our defenses up. It's embarrassing, after all, to reveal one's true feelings. As a seducer, you must find a way to lower these resistances. The charmer's approach of flattery and attention can be effective here, particularly with the insecure, but it can take months of work and can also backfire. To get a quicker result and to break down more inaccessible people, it's often better to alternate harshness and kindness. By being harsh, you create inner tensions. Your targets may be upset with you, but they are also asking themselves questions. What have they done to earn your dislike? When you then are kind, they feel relieved, but also concerned that at any moment they might somehow displease you again. Make use of this pattern to keep them in suspense, dreading your harshness and keen to keep you kind. Your kindness and harshness should be subtle. Indirect digs and compliments are best. Play the psychoanalyst. Make cutting comments concerning their unconscious motives. You're only being truthful. Then sit back and listen. Your silence will goad them into embarrassing admissions. Leaven your judgments with occasional praise, and they will strive to please you like dogs. Keys to Seduction. Almost everyone is more or less polite. We learn early on not to tell people what we really think of them. We smile at their jokes, act interested in their stories and problems. It's the only way to live with them. Eventually, this becomes a habit. We are nice, even when it isn't really necessary. We try to please other people, to not step on their toes, to avoid disagreements, conflict. Niceness in seduction, however, though it may at first draw someone to you, it is soothing, comforting, soon loses all effect. Being too nice can literally push the target away from you. Erotic feeling depends on the creation of tension. Without tension, without anxiety and suspense, there can be no feeling of release, of true pleasure and joy. It is your task to create that tension in the target, to stimulate feelings of anxiety, to lead them to and fro so that the culmination of the seduction has real weight and intensity. So rid yourself of your nasty habit of avoiding conflict, which is, in any case, unnatural. You are most often nice, not out of your own inner goodness, but out of fear of displeasing, out of insecurity. Go beyond that fear, and you suddenly have options. The freedom to create pain, then magically dissolve it. Your seductive powers will increase tenfold. People will be less upset by your hurtful actions than you might imagine. In the world today, we often feel starved for experience. We crave emotion, even if it's negative. The pain you cause your targets, then, is bracing. It makes them feel more alive. They have something to complain about. They get to play the victim. As a result, once you've turned the pain into pleasure, they will readily forgive you. Stir up their jealousy. Make them feel insecure, and the validation you later give their ego by preferring them over their rivals is doubly delightful. Remember, you have more to fear by boring your targets than by shaking them up. Wounding people binds them to you more deeply than kindness. Create tension so you can release it. If you need inspiration, find the part of the target that most irritates you and use it as a springboard for some therapeutic conflict. The more real your cruelty, the more effective it is. In 1818, the French writer Stendhal, then living in Milan, met the Countess Matilde Viscontini. For him, it was love at first sight. She was a proud, somewhat difficult woman, and she intimidated Stendhal, who was terribly afraid of displeasing her with a stupid comment or undignified act. Finally, unable to take it any longer, he one day took her hand and confessed his love. Horrified, the Countess told him to leave and never come back. Stendhal flooded Viscontini with letters, begging her to forgive him. At last, she relented. She would see him again, but under one condition. He could visit only once every 2 weeks for no more than an hour, and only in the presence of company. Stendhal agreed. He had no choice. He now lived for those short fortnightly visits, which became occasions of intense anxiety and fear, since he was never quite sure whether she would change her mind and banish him forever. This went on for over 2 years, during which the Countess never showed him the slightest sign of favor. Stendhal never found out why she had insisted on this arrangement. Perhaps she wanted to toy with him or keep him at a distance. All he knew was that his love for her only grew stronger, became unbearably intense, until finally he had to leave Milan. To get over this sad affair, Stendhal wrote his famous book On Love, in which he described the effect of fear on desire. First, if you fear the loved one, you can never get too close or familiar with him or her. The beloved then retains an element of mystery, which only intensifies your love. Second, there is something bracing about fear. It makes you vibrate with sensation, heightens your awareness, is intensely erotic. According to Stendhal, the closer the loved one brings you to the edge of the precipice, to the feeling that they could abandon you, the dizzier and more lost you will become. Falling in love means literally falling, losing control, a mix of fear and excitement. Apply this wisdom in reverse. Never let your targets get too comfortable with you. They need to feel fear and anxiety. Show them some coldness, a flash of anger they didn't expect. Be irrational if necessary. There is always the trump card, a breakup. Let them feel they have lost you forever. Make them fear that they have lost the power to charm you. Let these feelings sit with them for a while, then pull them back from the precipice. The reconciliation will be intense. In 33 BC, Mark Antony heard a rumor that Cleopatra, his lover of several years, had decided to seduce his rival, Octavius, and that she was planning to poison Antony. Cleopatra had poisoned people before. In fact, she was an expert in the art. Antony grew paranoid and finally one day confronted her. Cleopatra did not protest her innocence. Yes, that was true. It was quite within her power to poison Antony at any moment. There were no precautions he could take. Only the love she felt for him could protect him. To demonstrate, she took some flowers and dropped them into his wine. Antony hesitated, then raised the cup to his lips. Cleopatra grabbed his arm and stopped him. She had a prisoner brought in to drink the wine, and the prisoner promptly dropped dead. Falling at Cleopatra's feet, Antony professed that he loved her now more than ever. He did not speak out of cowardice. There was no man braver than he. And if Cleopatra could have poisoned him, he, for his part, could have left her and gone back to Rome. No, what pushed him over the edge was the feeling that she had control over his emotions, over life and death. He was her slave. Her demonstration of her power over him was not only effective, but erotic. Like Antony, many of us have masochistic yearnings without realizing it. It takes someone to inflict some pain on us for these deeply repressed desires to come to the surface. You must learn to recognize the types of hidden masochists out there, for each one enjoys a particular kind of pain. For instance, there are people who feel that they deserve nothing good in life and who, unable to deal with success, sabotage themselves constantly. Be nice to them, admit that you admire them, and they are uncomfortable, since they feel that they cannot possibly match up to the ideal figure you have clearly imagined them to be. Such self-saboteurs do better with a little punishment. Scold them, make them aware of their inadequacies. They feel they deserve such criticism, and when it comes, it is with a sense of relief. It is also easy to make them feel guilty, a feeling that deep down they enjoy. Other people experience the responsibilities and duties of modern life as such a heavy burden they long to give it all up. These people are often looking for someone or something to worship, a cause, a religion, a guru. Make them worship you. And then there are those who want to play the martyr. Recognize them by the joy they take in complaining, in feeling righteous and wronged. Then give them a reason to complain. Remember, appearances deceive. Often the strongest-looking people, the Kissingers and Don Mateos, may secretly want to be punished. In any event, follow up pain with pleasure, and you will create a state of dependency that will last for a long time. Reversal. People who have recently experienced a lot of pain or a loss will flee if you try to inflict more on them. They have enough in their lives already. Far better to surround these types with pleasure. That will put them under your spell. The technique of inflicting pain works best on those who have it easy, who have power and few problems. People with comfortable lives may also feel a gnawing sense of guilt as if they had gotten away with something. They may not consciously know it, but secretly they long for some punishment, a good mental thrashing, something that will bring them back down to earth. Also, remember to not use the pleasure through pain tactic too early on. Some of the greatest seducers in history, Byron, Jiang Qing, Madame Mao, Picasso, had a sadistic streak, an ability to inflict mental torture. If their victims had known in advance what they were getting themselves into, they would have run for the hills. In truth, most of these seducers lured their targets into their webs by appearing to be paragons of sweetness and affection. Even Byron seemed like an angel when he first met a woman, so that she tended to doubt his devilish reputation. A seductive doubt, for it allowed her to think of herself as the only one who really understood him. His cruelty would come out later on, but by then it would be too late. The victim's emotions were engaged, and his harshness would only intensify her feelings. In the beginning, then, wear the mask of a lamb, making pleasure and attentiveness your bait. First get under their skin, then lead them on a wild ride. Phase 4. Moving in for the kill. First, you worked on their mind, the mental seduction. Then you confused and stirred them up, the emotional seduction. Now the time has come for hand-to-hand combat, the physical seduction. At this point, your victims are weak and ripe with desire. By showing a little coldness or uninterest, you will spark panic. They will come after you with impatience and erotic energy. Chapter 21. Give them space to fall. The pursuer is pursued. To bring them to a boil, you need to put their minds to sleep and heat up their senses. It's best to lure them into lust by sending certain loaded signals that will get under their skin and spread sexual desire like a poison. Chapter 22. Use physical lures. The moment to strike and move in for the kill is when your victim is brimming with desire, but not consciously expecting the climax to come. Chapter 23. Master the art of the bold move. Once the seduction is over, there is the danger that disenchantment will set in and ruin all your hard work. Chapter 24. Beware the after effects. If you are after a relationship, then you must constantly re-seduce the victim, creating tension and releasing it. If your victim is to be sacrificed, then it must be done swiftly and cleanly, leaving you free, physically and psychologically, to move on to the next victim. Then, the game begins all over. Chapter 21. Give them space to fall. The pursuer is pursued. If your targets become too used to you as the aggressor, they will give less of their own energy and the tension will slacken. You need to wake them up, turn the tables. Once they are under your spell, take a step back and they will start to come after you. Begin with a touch of aloofness, an unexpected non-appearance, a hint that you're growing bored. Stir the pot by seeming interested in someone else. Make none of this explicit. Let them only sense it, and their imagination will do the rest, creating the doubt you desire. Soon, they will want to possess you physically, and restraint will go out the window. The goal is to have them fall into your arms of their own will. Create the illusion that the seducer is being seduced. Seductive gravity. In the early 1840s, the center of attention in the French art world was a young woman named Apollonie Sabatier. She was so much the natural beauty that sculptors and painters vied to immortalize her in their works, and she was also charming, easy to talk to, and seductively self-sufficient. Men were drawn to her. Her Paris apartment became a gathering spot for writers and artists, and soon Madame Sabatier, as she came to be known, although she was not married, was hosting one of the most important literary salons in France. Writers such as Gustave Flaubert, the elder Alexandre Dumas, and Théophile Gautier were among her regular guests. Near the end of 1852, when she was 30, Madame Sabatier received an anonymous letter. The writer confessed that he loved her deeply. Worried that she would find his sentiments ridiculous, he would not reveal his name, yet he had to let her know that he adored her. Sabatier was used to such attentions. One man after another had fallen in love with her, but this letter was different. In this man, she seemed to have inspired a quasi-religious ardor. The letter, written in a disguised handwriting, contained a poem dedicated to her, titled "To One Who Is Too Gay." It began by praising her beauty, yet ended with the lines, "And so, one night I'd like to sneak, when darkness tolls the hour of pleasure, a craven thief toward the treasure which is your person, plump and sleek. And most vertiginous delight into those lips so freshly striking, and daily lovelier to my liking, infuse the venom of my spite." Mixed in with her admirer's adoration, clearly, was a strange kind of lust, with a touch of cruelty to it. The poem both intrigued and disturbed her, and she had no idea who had written it. A few weeks later, another letter arrived. As before, the writer enveloped Sabatier in cult-like worship, mixing the physical and the spiritual. And as before, there was a poem, all in one, in which he wrote, "No single beauty is the best, since she is all one flower divine. Oh, mystic metamorphosis, my senses into one sense flow. Her voice makes perfume when she speaks. Her breath is music faint and low." Clearly, the author was haunted by Sabatier's presence and thought of her constantly. But now she began to be haunted by him, thinking of him night and day and wondering who he was. His subsequent letters only deepened the spell. It was flattering to hear that he was enchanted by more than her beauty, yet also flattering to know that he was not immune to her physical charms. One day, an idea occurred to Madame Sabatier as to who the writer might be. A young poet who had frequented her salon for several years, Charles Baudelaire. He seemed shy, in fact, had hardly spoken to her, but she had read some of his poetry, and although the poems in the letters were more polished, the style was similar. At her apartment, Baudelaire would always sit politely in a corner, but now that she thought of it, he would smile at her, strangely, nervously. It was the look of a young man in love. Now, when he visited, she watched him carefully, and the more she watched, the surer she was that he was the writer, but she never confirmed her intuition, because she did not want to confront him. He might be shy, and he was a man, and at some point he would have to come to her. And she felt certain that he would. Then, suddenly, the letters stopped coming, and Madame Sabatier could not understand why, since the last one had been even more adoring than all of the others before. Several years went by in which she often thought of her anonymous admirer's letters, but they were never renewed. In 1857, however, Baudelaire published a book of poetry, The Flowers of Evil, and Madame Sabatier recognized several of the verses. They were the ones he had written for her. Now they were out in the open for everyone to see. A little while later, the poet sent her a gift, a specially bound copy of the book and a letter, this time signed with his name. "Yes," he wrote, "he was the anonymous writer. Would she forgive him for being so mysterious in the past?" Furthermore, his feelings for her were as strong as ever. Quote, You didn't think for a moment that I could have forgotten you. You, to me, are more than a cherished image conjured up in a dream. You're my superstition, my constant companion, my secret. Farewell, dear madame. I kiss your hands with profound devotion. Unquote. This letter had a stronger effect on Madame Sabatier than the others had. Perhaps it was his childlike sincerity and the fact that he had finally written to her directly. Perhaps it was that he loved her, but asked nothing of her, unlike all the other men she knew, who at some point had always turned out to want something. Whatever it was, she had an uncontrollable desire to see him. The next day she invited him to her apartment alone. Baudelaire appeared at the appointed hour. He sat nervously in his seat, gazing at her with his large eyes, saying little, and what he did say was formal and polite. He seemed aloof. After he left, a kind of panic seized Madame Sabatier, and the next day she wrote him a first letter of her own. Quote, "Today I'm more calm, and I can feel more clearly the impression of our Tuesday evening together. I can tell you, without the danger of your thinking I'm exaggerating, that I'm the happiest woman on the face of the earth, that I've never felt more truly that I love you, and that I've never seen you look more beautiful, more adorable, my divine friend." Unquote. Madame Sabatier had never before written such a letter. She had always been the one who was pursued. Now she had lost her usual self-possession, and it only got worse. Baudelaire did not answer right away. When she saw him next, he was colder than before. She had the feeling there was someone else, that his old mistress, Jeanne Duval, had suddenly reappeared in his life and was pulling him away from her. One night, she turned aggressive, embracing him, trying to kiss him, but he did not respond and quickly found an excuse to leave. Why was he suddenly inaccessible? She began to flood him with letters, begging him to come to her. Unable to sleep, she would wait all night for him to show up. She had never experienced such desperation. Somehow, she had to seduce him, possess him, have him all to herself. She tried everything, letters, coquetry, all kinds of promises, until he finally wrote that he was no longer in love with her, and that was that. Interpretation. Baudelaire was an intellectual seducer. He wanted to overwhelm Madame Sabatier with words, dominate her thoughts, make her fall in love with him. Physically, he knew he could not compete with her many other admirers. He was shy, awkward, not particularly handsome. So he resorted to his one strength, poetry. Haunting her with anonymous letters gave him a perverse thrill. He had to know she would realize, eventually, that he was her correspondent. No one else wrote like him. But he wanted her to figure this out on her own. He stopped writing to her because he had become interested in someone else, but he knew she would be thinking of him, wondering, perhaps waiting for him. And when he published his book, he decided to write to her again, this time directly, stirring up the old venom he had injected in her. When they were alone, he could see she was waiting for him to do something, to take hold of her, but he was not that kind of seducer. Besides, it gave him pleasure to hold himself back, to sense his power over a woman whom so many desired. By the time she turned physical and aggressive, the seduction was over for him. He had made her fall in love. That was enough. The devastating effect of Baudelaire's push and pull on Madame Sabatier teaches us a great lesson in seduction. First, it is always best to keep at some distance from your targets. You do not have to go as far as remaining anonymous, but you don't want to be seen too often or to be seen as intrusive. If you're always in their face, always the aggressor, they will become used to being passive, and the tension in your seduction will flag. Use letters to make them think about you all the time, to feed their imagination. Cultivate mystery. Stop them from figuring you out. Baudelaire's letters were delightfully ambiguous, mixing the physical and the spiritual, teasing Sabatier with their multiplicity of possible interpretations. Then, at the point when they are ripe with desire and interest, when perhaps they are expecting you to make a move, as Madame Sabatier expected that day in her apartment, take a step back. You are unexpectedly distant, friendly, but no more than that. Certainly not sexual. Let this sink in for a day or two. Your withdrawal will trigger anxiety. The only way to relieve this anxiety is to pursue and possess you. Step back now, and you make your targets fall into your arms like ripe fruit, blind to the force of gravity that is drawing them to you. The more they participate, the more their willpower is engaged, the deeper the erotic effect. You have challenged them to use their own seductive powers on you, and when they respond, the tables will turn and they will pursue you with desperate energy. Keys to seduction. Since humans are naturally obstinate and willful creatures, and prone to suspicions of people's motives, it is only natural in the course of any seduction that in some ways your target will resist you. Seductions, then, are rarely easy or without setbacks. But once your victims overcome some of their doubts and begin to fall under your spell, they will reach a point where they start to let go. They may sense that you are leading them along, but they are enjoying it. No one likes things to be complicated and difficult, and your target will expect the conclusion to come quickly. That is the point, however, where you must train yourself to hold back. Deliver the pleasurable climax they're so greedily awaiting, succumb to the natural tendency to bring the seduction to a rapid end, and you will have missed an opportunity to ratchet up the tension, to make the affair more heated. After all, you don't want a passive little victim to toy with. You want the seduced to engage their will in all its force, to become active participants in the seduction. You want them to pursue you, hopelessly ensnaring themselves in your web in the process. The only way to accomplish this is to take a step back and make them anxious. You have strategically retreated before, see chapter 12. But this is different. The target is falling for you now, and your retreat will lead to panicky thoughts. You're losing interest. It's somehow my fault. Perhaps it's something I've done. Rather than think you're rejecting them on your own, your targets will want to make this interpretation, since if the cause of the problem is something they've done, they have the power to win you back by changing their behavior. If you are simply rejecting them, on the other hand, they have no control. People always want to preserve hope. Now they will come to you, turn aggressive, thinking that will do the trick. They will raise the erotic temperature. Understand, a person's willpower is directly linked to their libido, their erotic desire. When your victims are passively waiting for you, their erotic level is low. When they turn pursuer, getting involved in the process, brimming with tension and anxiety, the temperature is raised. So raise it as high as you can. When you withdraw, make it subtle. You are instilling unease. Your coldness or distance should dawn on your targets when they're alone, in the form of a poisonous doubt creeping into their mind. Their paranoia will become self-generating. Your subtle step back will make them want to possess you, so they will willingly advance into your arms without being pushed. This is different from the strategy in chapter 20, in which you're inflicting deep wounds, creating a pattern of pain and pleasure. There, the goal is to make your victims weak and dependent. Here, it is to make them active and aggressive. Which strategy you prefer to use, the two cannot be combined, depends on what you want and the proclivities of your victim. In Soren Kierkegaard's The Seducer's Diary, Johannes aims to seduce the young and beautiful Cordelia. He begins by being rather intellectual with her and slowly intriguing her. Then he sends her letters that are romantic and seductive. Now her fascination blossoms into love. Although in person he remains a little distant, she senses in him great depths and is certain that he loves her. Then one day, while they're talking, Cordelia has a strange sensation. Something about him is different. He seems more interested in ideas than in her. Over the next few days, this doubt gets stronger, the letters are a little less romantic, something is missing. Feeling anxious, she slowly turns aggressive, becomes the pursuer instead of the pursued. The seduction is now much more exciting, at least for Johannes. Johannes's step back is subtle. He merely gives Cordelia the impression that his interest is a little less romantic than the day before. He returns to being the intellectual. This stirs the worrisome thought that her natural charms and beauty no longer have as much effect on him. She must try harder, provoke him sexually, prove to herself that she has some power over him. She is now brimming with erotic desire, brought to that point by Johannes's subtle withdrawal of affection. Each gender has its own seductive lures, which come naturally to them. When you seem interested in someone but don't respond sexually, it is disturbing and presents a challenge. They will find a way to seduce you. To produce this effect, first reveal an interest in your targets through letters or subtle insinuation. But when you're in their presence, assume a kind of sexless neutrality. Be friendly, even warm, but no more. You are pushing them into arming themselves with the seductive charms that are natural to their sex. Exactly what you want. In the latter stages of the seduction, let your targets feel that you are becoming interested in another person. This is another form of taking a step back. When Napoleon Bonaparte first met the young widow, Josephine de Beauharnais, in 1795, he was excited by her exotic beauty and the looks she gave him. He began to attend her weekly soirees, and to his delight, she would ignore the other men and remain at his side, listening to him so attentively. He found himself falling in love with Josephine and had every reason to believe she felt the same. Then, at one soiree, she was friendly and attentive as usual, except that she was equally friendly to another man there, a former aristocrat, like Josephine, the kind of man that Napoleon could never compete with when it came to manners and wit. Doubts and jealousies began to stir within. As a military man, he knew the value of going on the offensive, and after a few weeks of a swift and aggressive campaign, he had her all to himself, eventually marrying her. Of course, Josephine, a clever seductress, had set it all up. She didn't say she was interested in another man, but his mere presence at her house, a look here and there, subtle gestures, made it seem that way. There is no more powerful way to hint that you are losing your desire. Make your interest in another too obvious, though, and it could backfire. This is not the situation in which you want to seem cruel. Doubt and anxiety are the effects you're after. Make your possible interest in another barely perceptible to the naked eye. Once someone has fallen for you, any physical absence will create unease. You are literally creating space. The Russian seductress Lou Andrea Salome had an intense presence. When a man was with her, he felt her eyes boring into him and often became entranced with her coquettish ways and spirit. But then, almost invariably, something would come up. She would have to leave town for a while, or would be too busy to see him. It was during her absences that men fell hopelessly in love with her and vowed to be more aggressive next time they were with her. Your absences at this latter point of the seduction should seem at least somewhat justified. You are insinuating not a blatant brush-off, but a slight doubt. Perhaps you could have found some reason to stay. Perhaps you're losing interest. Perhaps there is someone else. In your absence, their appreciation of you will grow. They will forget your faults, forgive your sins. The moment you return, they will chase after you as you desire. It will be as if you had come back from the dead. According to the psychologist,